Dr. Gisela Eisner, Ville 2.
How about saying goodbye to your family? You know, did all the family go with you to the station?
Yes, well, my father, my mother and Helmut. I mean, Stephen by that time had been arrested. Yes. Yes, I mean, we said goodbye, we kissed and hugged, and that was it.
Did you knew other children on the transport, did
no,
you?
No, I didn't know anybody. No. No.
I wonder how you felt, you know, getting on that a train of strangers and leaving home.
I didn't remember feeling anything. I've often thought about it, actually. I don't remember actually feeling anything for a long time. I mean, even when I arrived in Harwich and then went on to Dovercourt, I didn't remember sort of really feeling myself or feeling having normal sort of feelings. I must have been sort of quite numb. Mm.
What was the journey like, though? You know, how happy were you during that journey? It must have been quite long, wasn't it?
Well, we got to the Dutch border and had our luggage searched just before, and then these people got off the train. We went on. And I think fairly soon inside the Dutch border, the train stopped again for quite a long time. And there were a lot of really lovely women, sort of really comfortable, friendly, laughing, smiling women, who gave us food, lots of sandwiches and lots to drink. And we all stuffed ourselves. And I remember being absolutely amazed to see such white bread, because we all had grey bread in Germany. White bread with cheese, lots of thick slices of cheese, and I think there was milk and orange juice. I think we all ate far too much, and then the crossing was rough, and most of us were sick. It was horrible. And then we got to Harwich early in the morning. I can't remember any more about the long journey, really.
Well, can you remember anything about the atmosphere of the children, you know, about when you were sort of almost in England, where the house spirits were?
Well, almost in England was really the night time, wasn't it, on the crossing. And I think most of us were too busy. I was terribly sick. I was much too busy being sick to notice what anybody else was feeling. I think on the train most of the children were sort of really, really noisy and chatting away and sort of, yes.
What would the age group have been?
A lot of them seemed to be younger than I was on the train. But there must have been older ones somewhere else on the train, I don't know. Because when we got to the camp at Dovercourt, I know there were a lot of older children. I seemed to spend what time I did spend with other people, I spent with older children.
How about the carers? You know, who looked after the 200 children?
Where?
You know, during the journey, did you have people in charge, grown ups?
I don't remember. I just don't remember. I didn't remember any adults at all. I suppose there must have been some adults who kept an eye on us, but I just don't remember. No, I have no recollection of that.
Can you remember your first impression of England? What would you have seen, first of all, that impressed you, do you think?
The water and the docks and Harwich, the landing stage, and going down the gangway, and then there were an awful lot of people down below. There were cameras and so on, and they took photographs and film, and yes, I think there was a lot of publicity about it, wasn't there? I mean, I've seen sort of pictures taken of the first of children arriving, yes. I think it turned out to be a blessing for the children's refugee movement because they got a lot of people to volunteer to take children after that. Yes, we arrived in Dovercourt, in Harwich, and then we were taken to Dovercourt to this camp. And it was terribly cold. We had never known such cold before, because even if one was poor, one never felt cold in Berlin. I don't know why. I mean, our flats were never cold, and But this camp was terribly cold. It was a holiday camp. It was only built for summer use. And there were just sort of little wooden chalets, and we were put in there with sort of one blanket on the bed, as they would have done for the summer visitors. And then we all said we were cold, and somebody organized extra blankets, and they organized hot water bottles. And then they all had to show us how to fill hot water bottles. We had no idea how to fill a rubber hot water bottle. And yes, that was became all right then.
How long were you in that camp, Dovercourt?
Well, that's another puzzle, because this record I sent for from the children's movement has no entry, so I just don't know how long I was there. I imagine it must have been about a month.
So how did you spend your day? Can you remember how you would have sort of spent a typical day? This would have been 1938, would it?
Yes, December.
Yes,
it was practically the whole of December. We arrived on the 2nd of December. As I say, I don't remember when I left. It must have been early in January. And we weren't organized in any way. I mean, looking back on it, you would have thought that somebody would have immediately organized English classes or something obvious like that. But there was nothing like that. There were no sort of games or gym or anything like that. And there were a number of people who came to help. I think it became quite a thing for people to come along and help. And the person who I think was most efficient was some man who came. We were all amazed when we saw him. We'd never seen that before. He was terribly thin and tall and very jokey. And everybody remarked on his false teeth. They're terribly white, tombstones. And he was terribly good with us because he got us all to sing. He took us into the hall, and I imagine he must have been there to do that for the summer visitors. On the ceiling, there were sort of rolls of paper, and he sort of would take down one and turn, and they would give you the lyrics of a particular song, and then he got us all to sing things like Daisy, Daisy, Give Me Your Answer, Do, and sort of I Like a Cup of Tea in the Morning, and The Lambeth Walk, and things like that. And he kept us busy, and he got us all to sing. I mean, most of us had sort of been brought up on classical music and not popular music, and you know, there was this reluctance, and then there was the reluctance to say anything in English. And he was very good. He stood no nonsense. He got everybody to participate. But that is the only organ of sort of quasi-organized thing I can remember. They did take us to the cinema in Harwich on one occasion to see Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. No, I can't, really can't think that there was anything else. We never went for a walk or anything like that or had any games.
You were saying about the lack of English lessons. Mm. I suppose, would you have been communicating mainly in German?
Well, I only spoke to fellow German children, yes. Apart from this man who got us to sing in English, I mean, that was all communication was in German, yes. I learned no English, yes.
How about the food you were given at Dovercourt? Does that ring a bell?
No, not at all. I mean, I just used to eat anything I was given. It sort of never bothered me at all. I mean, looking back on it, I don't even know whether there are any children, Orthodox children there who required kosher food. I really didn't know about that. I dare say there were. There always were in any sort of group of children or adults.
The people who came to visit you, did you have any Jewish people come to see you or sort of look after you at all and, you know, give you hospitality at this stage?
I don't remember. I was invited out for tea once by a family. Took me to their home in Harwich. They were very nice. I don't think they were Jewish. I think they'd probably read all this publicity and decided, you know, to do their bit. They were very kind. They gave me a huge slab of chocolate to take back with me. I was absolutely amazed. Never seen such a big slab of chocolate. And what else? There were all sorts of people who turned up. There were some students who turned up. They either were German or had done German at college. I don't think they stayed very long, and I don't think, remember that they did anything. There were always lots of people walking about, and the place was always full of rumours, you know, that we were sort of more or less an auction, that they were looking around picking children out or something like that. I don't know whether that was true or not. I've been trying to find out how they actually decided to assign children to different families, and I've been able to get no information at all. That man Barry Turner in his book talks about somebody, it's in the book, who had run a school and she'd gone to help and she fell out with people because she didn't like the way they were selecting children to send to different families. But he doesn't give any details on what grounds she objected. So I just don't know. I just don't know how this was done. It's really a pity one can't get any information like that, because one has heard so many horror stories of what happened to ill-assigned children. I've only heard one marvelous example of somebody, and that was the viola player with the Amadeus Quartet, who had arrived with his violin, and somebody went to the camp and saw him standing there with a violin, and she was a music lover, and she said, I'll take that child. And she took him, and she was absolutely marvelous with him, you know, getting him to have music lessons with proper teachers, and set him up on the way. But I never kept contact with any of the people I was in good overcourt with.
Did you make any good friends there during the time? Were there people you felt close to?
No, there were people I talked to a lot and we met, but nobody I felt close to and kept in contact with afterwards. I've got some, again, entries in my autograph album from these people. Never kept in contact. I don't think I was in that sort of stage in which one makes friends. I didn't feel close to anybody.
It must have been quite a culture shock, you know, going from your home to this camp in England in December, you know, living in these little shacks. I wonder how, you know, you bore up with this. Were you feeling unhappy?
I don't remember feeling unhappy, but I think looking back, I must have been absolutely numb, because I just sort of have no feelings about it at all.
Had you heard, were you in touch with your family?
Yes, they wrote. And I had an uncle in London, and I think my mother must, it was her brother, and she must have written to him, because sometime early in January I was suddenly told to pack my case, and that was going off to family known to my uncle, and he hadn't actually been in touch with me or his wife. And
was that surprising to you?
Absolutely stunning. I had no idea. And again, I would like to know on how the organization actually managed to did all this, because they had assumed responsibility for me. Now, did they just sort of take my uncle's word for it that these people were suitable to have charge of me? I would dearly like to know to what extent they actually checked up. I mean, on the face of it, they were terribly busy. They were overwhelmed with all these children they had to deal with, and they knew that more and more children would be coming in, you know, week after week. They obviously had to do things quickly. But nevertheless, I would like to know whether they actually sort of checked up. Anyway, that turned out to be an absolute disaster. I was put on a train. I don't know whether anybody else was there. I just don't remember that. I was sort of, you know, still numb. And in Liverpool Street, there was this family, a Mr. and Mrs. Marx and their daughter. And they took me to their home in Hanwell. And Mr. Marx, I think, must have been a bachelor most of his life. He'd only recently married this woman and her daughter. He was Jewish, she wasn't Jewish. And I don't know whether she'd been his housekeeper before or what, but they were sort of rather distant with each other, and they weren't at all nice to me. And I don't know whether this was just sort of a rash undertaking. He'd perhaps sort of, and only heard afterwards from my aunt that this man had said he'd like to give a home to a little girl from a little refugee girl. And my uncle said, well, it so happens that I have a niece who's a little refugee girl in this camp. So this, I think, is how it happened. And I wasn't the little refugee girl. When I got to them, they sort of said they'd expected a little refugee girl, which I find extraordinary too. I mean, I can understand that my uncle would still think of me as a little refugee girl because he'd seen me last in Berlin a few years earlier, and I obviously sort of grown since then. But nevertheless, you'd think that these people, when they sort of decided to take responsibility for me, must have seen some sort of evidence of my existence. They must have seen my birth certificate or something, or some sort of thing. They must have known how old I was. Anyway, that was their excuse. They didn't really enjoy having me.
How was this sort of manifested? What, you know, how did they treat you? Can you think of examples?
Well, in a very cold, distant sort of way. The only good thing they did for me was to send me to school, because I was still of school age, and they sent me to an ordinary sort of free secondary school or elementary school. What was it called then? Secondary school?
Yes,
you know, the one people went to until they were 14.
Yes.
Compulsory education.
Yes. Would it be an elementary?
Yes, it would be elementary, wouldn't it? Yes.
How about the language situation? You know, when you went to this family, for instance, did you know any, apart from Daisy Daisy and the songs you were singing?
I had a little school English from my school in Berlin, and obviously not terribly terribly good, but it was enough. We got by. I mean, I don't think any of the distant feeling was due to lack of language, because they could have overcome that soon enough. Yes, I went to school. I liked the school. The girls were all terribly nice. They were all very, I think they must have all been very poor, but they always had some money to buy sweets at break time. Children always had access to lots and lots of sweets, and that really amazed me. That was the big culture difference between Berlin and England. The children here ate such a lot of sweets, and sweets were cheap. Just for a penny, you could get a great big bag full of sweets. And these girls used to take me with them. They just had half a penny, I think, and they bought sweets, and they'd always give me some of them. They were terribly nice. I think it was a very organized sort of school. I had my place at a desk, and I sat there. I didn't remember what I listened to or what I did, but
Where was the school?
These people lived in Hanwell, which is somewhere out in Ealing, that sort of way, and the school must have been there. It was sort of one of these tall, forbidding-looking schools.
How did the teachers treat you?
Very nice, yes. Yes, they were very nice. I think they were sort of quite pleased to have somebody different there.
Would you have been the only refugee?
Yes, yes. Yes, they were very nice. Yes, no problem at all. The girls were very nice. My only problem was my domestic situation there, because really it was a terribly lonely, miserable sort of existence. I mean, they never sort of really talked, and I remember spending a lot of time in my room by myself. And her daughter, Mrs. Mark's daughter, was a lot older. She was already in her 20s, and I don't think she had any interest in this little 13-year-old.
Did anyone come by to check up?
No. Yes.
How about your uncle?
I don't think I saw him. Or perhaps No, I think they did take me round to his house once. He did, and Mr. Marx did have a car. Yes, he took me round to my uncle's house. He lived in Edgware, in North London. And, yes. I don't know how long I was with these people, but Mrs. Marx obviously got fed up with all this. She didn't enjoy it, and she didn't obviously, quite clearly, didn't want me around. I mean, you know, she, her life was quite comfortable without me there. And one day she did the classic thing, which I'd always heard about. She put me in a taxi with my luggage, my suitcase, and told the taxi driver to take me to St. Margaret's Road, Edgware, and pay the fare. And then the taxi driver took me to St. Margaret's Road, Edgware, where my uncle's house was, and that's where I was. And then it turned out that my aunt was no more pleased to see me than Mrs. Marx had been. She didn't want me at all. I mean, they lived quite comfortably. My uncle had gone to London as a dress designer. He was quite well paid when he came over. And then in time, he changed over to production. And I think he had a proprietary interest in the company he was with. And I think they were quite well off. I mean, the house wasn't all that big. I mean, it seemed to be big and luxurious to me, coming from the sort of circumstances I'd ended up with in Berlin. But it was all right. They had a three-bedroomed house. And I was put on a bed in my cousin's room. They just had the one daughter. And at that time, they had a live-in maid. And, I mean, I can't really say that they were overcrowded because I was there, but my aunt would have preferred it if I hadn't been there. And she made no bones about it. She just didn't want me there. And she spent all her time ringing up Bloomsbury House. You know, that Bloomsbury House was the place that housed, accommodated the Refugee Children's Association movement. All their records were there, and that's where everything took place. So she rang them up every day, and I told them that they'd got to find me somewhere. And then on occasions, well, I say on occasions, I think it was quite often actually, but every third day, I had to go with her to Bloomsbury House. You see, she didn't believe that these telephone messages would get delivered, would get to the right person, so she would drag me down there. And we'd sit in this place. It was a very miserable, depressing place because it was full of people who wanted somewhere to live, full of refugees who needed jobs and money and accommodation. I mean, really hard up, older adult people. And my aunt took me along there and to remind these people that I was there. And in time, they actually found somewhere for me to stay, and they sent me off to Wolverhampton to a family.
Well, was your aunt Jewish?
My aunt? Mm. Yes, yes.
Do you think they had any idea of what was happening in Germany? You know,
oh, they must have done, yes, most definitely, yes. Yes, because my grandmother had been to stay with them during the previous year, and she'd gone back because she wanted to be with my grandfather. And then, as I told you, he was deported to Poland, and then she managed to go and join him in Poland. And yes, my aunt knew that there were people, were sort of the other sort of sisters was trying to come get out of Germany. And this was one of the things I remember she told these people in Bloomsbury House, that they had to find somewhere for me quickly because she needed the bed for the next refugee who was going to turn up and stay with her. So, actually, in fact, the only person who did come to actually needed a bed with her was a younger aunt, and she actually took over from the maid afterwards. But that was some time later. Yes, my aunt was not at all nice, yes. And she didn't even disguise her unhappiness with my presence, so it really wasn't very nice.
I wonder how you coped with that. You would now be 14, I suppose. Is that right?
I wasn't quite. No, this was No, I think I left them round about the time of my birthday, so I was still 13 years. I mean, at the time, it seemed an endless time, but it probably wasn't more than a month before they found this. I was probably about a month with the Marx family and perhaps 6 weeks or something like that with my aunt.
Was there anyone, you know, you could sort of talk to or who No. gave you any comfort at all?
No, only my cousin, Helga, but she was 2 years younger than I was. And she used to be sort of full of her school life. I mean, sort of, you know, she was 11 at the time. I mean, I couldn't pour out my heart to her.
Yes, were you going to school when you stayed with your uncle?
No. I had the unadulterated pleasure of my aunt.
And did they make any attempt to help you with your English?
No, well, my aunt's English was very poor, appallingly poor, considering how long they'd been there. She could just about sort of do her shopping. And, I mean, when we went to Bloomsbury House, we always had to have somebody there, some German-speaking woman, to deal with her because she couldn't have coped in English. My aunt couldn't have coped in English. Yes. I really can't think of anything nice to say about my aunt, really. She was horrible to me. And... Yes, full stop.
Your brother, Heinz.
Yes.
I know he was travelling and he often came to Britain, I understand. Yeah. Did you hear from him during this period? Certainly when you first came to England.
No, he was in the concentration camp. He was arrested in the Kristallnacht and he was released round about Christmas. And then he had to get his papers together and everything, and then he finally came to England at Whitsun, so that was May. Yes.
So where did you actually go after, once your aunt had got rid of you?
Yes. I mean, that was an absolute godsend, absolute blessing. I was put with a family in Wolverhampton, and I was actually taken... accompanied on the train journey by somebody from Wolverhampton, a lady who sort of was renowned for doing good work. She was a Quaker, and I think she'd volunteered to do this sort of job, and she accompanied me. She was very nice. I mean, she was so absolutely different from my aunt. She didn't say nasty things about Jews from Eastern Germany or anything like that. And
yeah, she was. What you had to put up with, sort of. Personal insults from your aunt?
Well, they weren't personal to me. They were just sort of insults about our general family. I mean, this was, in a way, yes, it was really quite awful, yes. Anti-Semitism from a different quarter, if you like. But I don't suppose she was the only one who felt like that. Yes, I was taken to Wolverhampton. I was met there. And it was a family who knew how old I was, and they had wanted somebody of my sort of age because they had a daughter who was 2 years older and they had a son of my sort of age, so I fitted in very nicely with them. And they were very kind and very considerate, and they treated me just like their own children.
What were they called?
Gwinnett. Gwinnett. It's a very rare name. Actually, oddly enough, I came across the name. The only other time I came across the name was in Washington last year when, like a proper tourist, I went round the Capitol and I saw a copy of the Declaration of Independence. And on the top are all the important people who signed the Declaration of Independence, but on the bottom are another 50 signatories. And among those was the name Gwinnett. So I wrote to Joyce about it, and I said, she said, how terribly clever to you to find it, but he's somebody we don't talk about. He was the black sheep of the family. They did all sorts of terrible things in England, and they shipped him off to the States, and that was his doing. The making of the man, he ended up by becoming governor of Georgia. So, yes, that was a little sidelight. Yes, they were very nice to me. Oh yes, I'm fidgeting again. Mr. Gwinnett had a very humble sort of job, really. He was a clerk for the Inland Revenue, but they lived very well, and they lived very well simply because they were highly organized. They were organized right through and everywhere you can imagine.